Welcome to the keynote stage. So my name is Mark Walsh. I'm the founder of this conference and part of the leadership team with Daniela and Manel. We have got quite a feast, quite a treat in store for you. The main stage doesn't have all the top names on. Some of them are spread out for various logistical reasons, but there are some awesome presenters on this stage. This stage is also sponsored by Alain Stefani. When we first had the idea of getting sponsors, I basically said, I won't take anyone as a sponsor unless I love what they do, because otherwise it doesn't have any integrity for me. I didn't know who Alain Stefani was, but I met her in Berlin. Someone said, oh, she's an intimacy teacher, she's an ex-sex worker, best-selling author in Germany. And I said, okay, well, I'll meet her. And I met her. And as soon as I met her, I felt at ease. I felt like, wow, this is a person who's playful, but also a deep listener. This is a woman who's a real leader. Since I've seen her work with people in very, you know, around trauma, around intimacy, around very difficult areas, men and women, I've come to regard her as a friend, actually. Like, I love her. So go to her website and check it out. It's Alain, I-L-A-N, Stefani, S-T-E-P-H-A-N for November, I. AlainStefani.com. There's an offer there called Love and Rage, which is as juicy as it sounds. You'll also find links in the descriptions for the videos below. So welcome to the main stage of the Embodiment Conference today, Jon Kabat-Zinn. Wow. So when I was a wee lad, meditation and mindfulness, well, meditation was the word people use, was sort of something done by weird hippies that most people either didn't know about or thought was sort of something strange. And it wasn't particularly well known or well received. And then some scientific research started happening. Foremost among that, I think, was Jon Kabat-Zinn really leading that movement with his mindfulness-based stress reduction. And this gave what many of us sort of knew subjectively an objective legitimacy, and meant that, you know, governments, businesses, schools, people that might not otherwise have looked at it took it really seriously. And that really sparked a whole revolution. So Jon Kabat-Zinn is someone that I think we actually all owe a huge debt of gratitude to. Without him, my friends would still be pointing at me and laughing. Without him, I wouldn't be able to go into businesses and take this work to soldiers or police or people that really need it. The world is better for him doing this research and putting it forward. Let me say it as simple as that. So yes, he's a great author, he's a biologist, he's a teacher, but I think we're all standing on those shoulders, and this whole conference wouldn't exist without him. So Jon, you are so welcome, sir. Over to you.
Well, thank you, Mark. That's very touching to hear you say that. And whether it's true or to what degree it's true, we're all in some sense at a critical moment on the planet, and anything we can do to mobilize the full range of our human capacities to tilt things in a direction of well-being as opposed to a direction of dystopia is a very important contribution to make, however small we feel our contribution might be. And of course, less than 2 weeks before the election of the president in the United States, all of these concerns have come to the fore enormously. So let me just say that I'm delighted to be here. And the only reason I'm here is because I really like the word embodiment. And so I felt like, if there's an embodiment conference, sure, I'd like to participate in that. And because it's a big mystery, I'm not even sure that I could define the term embodiment, but I think we all know what we at least mean, or we know it when we see it in another person. Some people feel 100% authentic, namely there's no separation between whatever they profess or whatever comes out of their mouth and how they actually carry themselves in their life. And then we say that person really embodies what they teach, or embodies a sense of profound presence, or whatever it is. So from a research point of view, embodiment is becoming a more and more interesting subject, and it's very closely related to phenomenology, that whole field of philosophy that has to do with presence and the more than human world and the different dimensions of experience that are possible to inhabit in a way that makes us feel at home. So meditation practice, however you understand the word meditation, is really an invitation to embody your full humanity in the only moment you or I or anybody else ever has. And that's, of course, the present moment. And so before we go into more talk or whatever it is that we're going to wind up doing together, of course, movement would be a huge piece of this, that we actually get up and move around, use our bodies playfully, explore and experiment what the boundaries and limits of movement of the body might be, whether it's balance, strength, or flexibility, and all of which are completely enfolded into what we call mindful yoga. And of course, if yoga isn't being practiced or taught mindfully, it's not really yoga at all. It'd be more like calisthenics or exercise. So once again, embodiment is really at the heart of all meditative practice. And certainly that's the case in the Buddhist tradition, where mindfulness had its most elaborate articulation, because the four foundations of mindfulness as taught by the Buddha himself, the first of those four foundations is the body, that we actually can pay attention to the body, starting with what we most have in common about the body, and that is, of course, the fact that we're all breathing. Excuse me. So let's take a few moments now. Of course, people are from around the world, but whatever it is that brought you to this particular presentation at this particular moment, whatever time zone you're in, let's actually just give ourselves over to remembering, recalling, reaffirming that we're already, the language gets funny here, but in the body, and seeing if we can actually embrace the full experience of being present in the body. So this is really a non-doing. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to get anything right, because you're already right. Everything is right with you, including what you think is wrong with you. It's a very vast embrace. And so let's actually just tune in as per the instructions for the first foundation of mindfulness, the classical instructions, to a sense of the body sitting here breathing. And if you like, I invite you to close your eyes. You certainly don't have to stare at my face on the screen, or to let your eyes just fall gently on the screen or unfocused. But the most important part is to direct your attention to the body as a whole, sitting here breathing. And through your attending, through your paying attention, to actually experience awareness of the body sitting here right now, breathing. And you might ask yourself, oh, what is different from this moment that the body's here sitting and breathing, and the moment before I invited you to enter this period of formal meditation practice? Is there any difference whatsoever except your intention to all of a sudden fall awake, be present? And in the vast field of your human awareness that's always available to you, to feature center stage in that vast field, or on that vast stage, so to speak, your body sitting here breathing. So simply dropping in and taking up residency in this awareness, feeling the feet, however they are configured. If you're sitting in a chair, you're sitting cross-legged on the floor, but to feel the entirety of the lower body anchored in your, to your seat. And the central core of the body self-elevating through the spine, the torso, the arms and hanging off the shoulders, which themselves are hanging off the rib cage, in front through the collarbones and in back through the scapulae, the shoulder blades, the continuation of the spine in the cervical area, the neck region, 7 vertebrae culminating in the axis and atlas that are actually holding up the heavy, remarkable housing of the head and skull and cranium and everything that is part and parcel of this region. And just dropping underneath any thoughts about it, any kind of narration, and experiencing being fully awake. Moment by moment by moment, as this breath comes into the body, as this breath leaves the body, and we're riding with full awareness on the waves of in-breath and out-breath as the body breathes itself, so to speak, or is breathed. So we don't have to look for the control knobs and start fiddling with and manipulating our breath or thinking about it, but to just befriend it. Snuggle up to it, so to speak. Luxuriate in the miracle of it. So awareness suffusing the body, surrounding the body. So here we are already in the profoundest of ways, already embodied without having made any effort whatsoever The breath is doing itself. All we can do is get out of the way, so to speak. So striving for embodiment would, in some sense, be the exact opposite of embodiment. Embodiment is a kind of core dimension of human experience. And the degree to we drift away from it is the degree to which we're carried away by thinking. By, as we say in English, at least, getting lost in thought. And missing the somatic magnitude of this moment. It's still here. It's always here. But are we? So that's the challenge of a practice like this, is it's non-trivial and it looks really easy. Oh, it's just breathing and paying attention. Well, it turns out that's just about the hardest and most challenging thing for us human beings to give ourselves over to. And even stringing two moments of mindfulness together, even in one in-breath and one out-breath without being distracted, is a significant challenge. And we live in an age of perpetual self-distraction with our devices, with all of the drivenness to get to some better moment at some better time. And that's the exact opposite of embodiment too, because there is no better moment at some better time. This is it. And the fact is, it always has been. So as we continue to ride on the waves of our breath in the body, dropping underneath my words to whatever degree you like, so that it's not like my words are in some sense preventing you from being embodied or being awake or being present. It's simply like the sound of the wind in the trees, with a reminder every once in a while. As I look out the window, beyond my laptop, I'm seeing the New England leaves in, just in multiplicity of colors falling off the trees by the thousands. And just kind of like giving themselves over to gravity after a whole season or several seasons strung together, spring and summer and early fall. And now it's time for them to drop. When is your time to drop into this moment, into this body? So although I'm doing a certain amount of talking and pointing out various aspects of the landscape in this guided meditation, please recognize that the invitation is to rest in total silence inside, underneath, and in between my words as you're hearing them. And that kind of is a kind of signature invitation to reaffirm for yourself what you already know, that the real meditation practice is life itself. It wouldn't be that useful if you had to hermetically seal yourself up in some present moment isolation. The real challenge is, how are we going to be in relationship to any and every moment that arises? And can we be embodied? Can we show up fully in our body, in our heart? In our mind? How is the mind related to the body? Is it synonymous with brain? Even here, the mysteries abound. We hardly know what the full potential of being human is. And we're at a moment on the history of life on this planet, the evolution, so to speak, and now cultural evolution of life on this planet, where we really, waking up is not going to be a luxury. It's an absolute necessity if we hope to take care of the planet in a way that allows it to be livable for our children and grandchildren. To say nothing of biotech and infotech and all of the various ways in which our technologies are so precocious and so advanced that they've gone way beyond our capacity for clarity and thought, because we haven't developed this embodied wakefulness and haven't put a foundation under it that is ethical and moral and understands harming when it arises, even in our own minds or actions. And then it also understands what would the antidote to be to those kinds of impulses, basically driven by greed, hatred, and delusion, the three classical toxins, so to speak, to tilt things in the direction of kindness, of compassion, of deep appreciation for interconnectedness. So the stakes in this moment are enormous for the planet, for our species at least, and for future generations. So this is no joke, and it's not merely some kind of romantic orientalism or, you know, sort of Zen play or fantasy or pretend. This is it, folks. And it's not about attaining some kind of ideal. And so embodied wakefulness is really available with this in-breath, if you're willing to be here with it, is manifesting with this out-breath. I shouldn't even say attainable, because we're not attempting to attain anything. If anything, we're learning how to write ourselves a kind of a legal restraining order to get out of our own way and keep getting out of our own way. Or investigating what our true way might be with a capital W. What is my true way? As in Tao, T-A-O or D-A-O, path. And so here we are in this moment. The breath coming in, breath leaving the body. And no agenda for this moment in time, at least for those of you who are crazy enough to have tuned into this particular program. You don't have anything else that's competing for your attention, or if you do, go and do it and shut off your laptop or whatever device you're on. You see, you have infinite agency here, what I sometimes call sovereignty. So the sort of capacity to actually keep fine-tuning your attention instead of having it be robbed by the social media, all of the different ways in which the digital world is impinging on our lives that may not be entirely for our own benefit. And in fact, people talk about it as surveillance capitalism and a race to the bottom of the brainstem. If you haven't seen the movie on Netflix, The Social Dilemma, you better watch it now, soon. Don't let 24 hours go by without seeing it. Most of the people in that film are mindfulness practitioners and tech engineers who created a lot of what's now problematic about the way the internet is being monetized, and where you do have continual sort of surveillance systems where, you know, we think that the internet is for our benefit, but it may not be for our benefit. We're more like we're not the customer, we're the product. Our attention is being sold to other people to seduce us into buying stuff or hating some group of people or believing stuff that's totally patently untrue. And then getting lost in that and losing our minds and potentially losing our integrity and potentially causing great harm to other people. total delusion. This has been going on forever. The internet did not invent greed, hatred, or delusion. Capitalism did not invent greed, hatred, and delusion. Surveillance capital has not invented greed, hatred, and delusion. And we need to own it. This is part of the work of embodiment, is actually biting into our own delusion, swallowing it, digesting it, putting out the welcome mat for it, metabolizing it, and realizing the fallacy of it, the false promise of happiness or some golden moment where everything will come together for you. This is it. This is it. If there's any way to have a golden moment, hey, what's wrong with the golden dimension of this moment? No matter what's going on in your life, your eyes are probably not going to get any better over the rest of your lifetime. If they can see, how often have you taken a moment and appreciated that? How about your ears? I assume that most of you are hearing this, although I know it's being translated in 6 or 8 languages, and how wonderful that is. I'm not knocking the internet or the digital world, because look what it's able to do for us in the time of pandemic and in many, many other ways. But it has to be, in some sense, regulated through wisdom as opposed to driven by greed and a certain kind of power and the kind of insane concentrations of wealth that it's producing for an insanely small number of people at the expense, not just of our pocketbooks, but of potentially our future and even our present. So you can't have been meditating for very long, or however long you've been meditating for, without knowing that the mind has a life of its own, and whoever is doing the guidance of the meditation, or you're doing practicing without any guidance, it doesn't take more than a few microseconds to realize that the mind has a life of its own. And even though you've told it to drop into the breath in the body and feel the body as a whole sitting and breathing, in very short order, the mind's going to be off someplace else. And it's going to tune me out, and it's not going to follow anything that I'm saying. It's just going to kind of like, and maybe you can then blame me, because maybe my talk is triggering those kinds of distractions in you. So this is a skill, it's a muscle that we develop by practicing. When you notice, excuse me, that the mind has wandered off, don't think you're a failure. Don't judge it, or notice how easily you judge that, oh, I'm not a good meditator, because if I were, my mind wouldn't drift. It's in the nature of the mind to be intoxicated with anything and everything, and to not just drift, but completely lose itself in the thought stream, emotional reactivity, in fear, whatever it is. And there's plenty of fear afoot in the world at the moment. And I think a lot of it is focused on the US election coming up in, you know, 12 days or whatever it is. So there's plenty to be fearful of, but in this guided meditation that we're all engaged in, even if it may not look like totally silent meditation, the invitation is to notice it when your mind sort of takes off, whether it's because of something I've said, or just because of fatigue, and it goes someplace else. And there's a certain moment in which you'll notice that your mind is no longer in your body. So no longer embodied. That's when the practice really comes to life. It's not like you're a failure. It's like, oh, rich, juicy moment, because now I get to see what's on my mind. When I have that, oh, I was supposed to be meditating and look where I am. Wonderful. So look where you are. See what's on your mind. Then here's the hard part. Let it be. Don't push it away, but also don't pursue it, even if it's very attractive or more interesting than your breath and your body. Come back to the breath and the body. And then if the mind wanders a million times, each time notice what's on your mind and then come back. Notice you don't have to do this with your phone, with your device, okay? You can do this all by yourself. Of course, we're using laptops so we can communicate and all be in the same moment beyond time and space. And that is a miracle and a fantastic use of the technology. But at the same time, if you only do it now because somebody's giving a talk on embodiment, the talk on embodiment will have been of no use whatsoever. My agenda for all of us, myself included, is for this to become our default mode of functioning, that we are falling awake as a way of being embodied constantly. Whether we're even moving to open a door or getting ready for bed, or walking in the woods or down the street, or picking up a 2-year-old, or playing with a 10-year-old, horsing around, or getting into whatever. It's all one seamless whole. And it's not called meditation, it's called life. But when life and meditation are seamlessly one and the same, or as Thich Nhat Hanh likes to say, interbe, then every moment is a perfect moment for falling awake and for falling into the body, if you don't mind my putting it that way, just being fully present. It's not hard, but it's really, really hard to remember. And it's really, really hard to continually bring your mind back. And speaking of devices, one wonderful meditation practice would be to notice how many times a day your mind goes to this supercomputer that we carry around in our pockets and purses. And not just supercomputer, but completely wired to this other universe that we call the internet, this digital universe. Just noticing, here's a wonderful mindfulness meditation practice. How many times I have to check whatever platform is your favorite platform? And the fact is, the answer to how many times you have to check is zero. You don't have to check. That doesn't mean you have to throw your phone away or abandon WeChat or, you know, whatever platform you're on. You know, Twitter or Facebook or whatever, but to notice whether actually you're addicted to it and whether you're not getting off on those little squirts of dopamine that happen every time, you know, you have a little bit of a frisson of some kind because somebody liked something you said or responded to you or, you know, made you feel good. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's much more healthy if you can be aware of it. At the moment that it's happening, in your body, and how the body feels, say, even when you get caught up in something, because a lot of the time it might be a memory of, you know, pain or suffering or trauma, as has been discussed a lot in this conference. And we're all carrying trauma in the body to one degree or another, sometimes horrific degrees of trauma, sometimes just kind of mini or what we call little t traumas, but any kind of way in which we have been over the entire course of our lives, including in utero, disregarded for our wholeness, for our embodiedness, is a form of trauma. And yet our capacity for awareness can heal that trauma, because no matter how big the trauma, our awareness, our heartfulness is capable of holding it and not fixing anything or making it go away or curing it, but to just recognize it. And in the recognizing, some other function is operational that nurtures profound embodied interconnectedness, a sense of being whole as you are, whole, complete. The root meaning, by the way, of the words healthy, healing, and for that matter, holy, H-O-L-Y. So this is a profoundly human experience to be fully embodied outside of time. And every moment is a moment for that. So whether it's digital distraction or analog distraction, when we recognize the distraction in our minds, when we're meditating, mind goes off, you bring it back. Mind goes off, you bring it back. Mind goes off, you bring it back. Almost like a windshield wiper. The mind never doesn't go off. Don't judge that, okay? Just notice, okay, the mind is a windshield wiper. So let it be. But you know what? When it's raining, you can use the windshield wiper. You need the windshield wiper in order to see through the nature of reality of driving a car in the rain. And so there's no impediment. There's no problem. So it's the same with the meditation practice. There's no problem with the mind coming and going and wandering, being all over the place, and actually feeling enormous pain. That's part of the healing work of embodiment, is to actually put the welcome mat out for things as they are and embrace it all in awareness through non-doing. You don't have to fix, you don't have to cure, you don't have to, non-doing. Just embracing it like a mother might embrace her child or a father. It's like, for, you know, the child, just the embrace makes it better in some profound way. Lets you know there's an orthogonal dimension of reality that as a child you may not understand, for that matter, as a big person, you may not understand, but that can hold this all in a way that gives us new degrees of freedom to navigate the ups and downs and the challenges of the insane complexity of life in this moment of time, in a very, very challenging moment. But you know, there've been challenging moments forever. It's part of parcel of human history. So we could say, oh yeah, but all of these problems, whatever they are, they're like, you know, this has never happened before on the planet. Yeah, well, this hasn't happened before on the planet, but believe me, something else has happened on the planet and you would not have loved it, whether you were back in the Crusades or whether you were in the Holocaust or whether you were in all of the genocides that have happened around the world. It wouldn't be like, well, you know, that's nothing compared to what we're in now. It's all the same full catastrophe of the human condition. When the mind doesn't know itself, we're capable of insane levels of harm, both intentional harm and actually just accidental harm by omission. You didn't mean to hurt your spouse's feelings, but it came out of your mouth and it was like wickedly wounding. So this is a phenomenal opportunity to work with these energies and liberate ourselves from them, so to speak, not over time, but outside of time in this moment without any effort. It's not like we're not trying to get to some special mindful state. So any of you are hearing this or me talk for the first time and have the feeling like I'm talking about getting to some special something that then you'll know, aha, this was what John was talking about. And I just feel like completely at one with the universe and fully embodied and yet no body at all. I'm just boundless space and beyond time and all of that stuff. No, it's about this moment as you're experiencing it, with all of your intelligences, of which there are far more, and senses, of which there are far more than five. And mindfulness or mindful awareness or compassion being the most profound and the most ignored so far in all, virtually all of our cultures. And so I really see the meditation practice as a love affair, not as, oh, one more thing I have to find time in my busy day and schedule into my calendar. I'll be mindful from 1 to 101 in the afternoon. No. How about letting mindfulness become our default mode and mindlessness be the kind of thing that arises for a moment here or a moment there? That takes one strong intentionality. So intention and attention, the things that are most at risk now in the digital age. Our attention has become a commodity, and we are becoming in some sense slaves, unwitting slaves to our own desires or interests or attachments or nucleus accumbens, you know, dopamine hits. Because there are pleasure centers in the brain, so to speak, that give us these kind of moments of pleasure or feeling of meaning, of connection. And then we get seduced by them. We get, you know, but that's not actually remotely in the realm of well-being or happiness even, or eudaimonia, to use a term that Aristotle originally, you know, coined. Like the capacity to actually not so much be happy as to be complete, to be whole, which may be the most profound happiness or well-being at all, not a caricature of itself. So in the Heart Sutras, those of you who have sat my a retreat with me, or you know, the online mitigation retreat that went on for 13 weeks that some of you I can see on the screen were part of, will know that I'm very fond of quoting the Heart Sutra, because it is kind of this non-dual embodied practice that reminds us that there is no place to go, no special something to attain, and nothing to do. So again, for those of you who are new to the practice, meditation is not about self-improvement or getting someplace else or being whatever your concept of embodiment is. That would be a caricature of it, a joke. Mindfulness practice, getting out of our own way and then recognizing you can't not be embodied when you're true to yourself, when you're distracted, when you're off someplace else, or when you're the victim of your own addictions. There's no way you can be embodied because you're too busy paying attention to all the wrong things and looking to complete yourself in ways that are completely impossible, because guess what? You're already complete. It was St. Francis actually who said, as far as I remember, that what you're looking for, if you're looking for something, is who is looking. So who is that? Who wants embodiment? Who's interested? Who tuned in? Who wants to make a big deal of it? Who actually is meditating? Who is breathing? These are non-trivial questions, because they all boil down to the fundamental challenge of us as Homo sapiens sapiens, to understand what the sapiens part means. It's from the Latin sapere, which means to taste or to know, intimate knowing by biting into. Okay, so that's not cognition, that's pure awareness. So we're the species that is capable of pure awareness and is capable of bringing pure awareness to that pure awareness. We're capable of it. I'm asserting that. Others have asserted that across time. But a lot of the time, if we're perpetually distracted, that's just an abstraction that has no grounding. And where would it be grounded? First foundation of mindfulness, the body, the breath, this moment, and the intimacy of it beyond thinking. Although thinking can be used to keep us on target, to refocus, and to actually remember what we're supposed to be doing in the practice and remember the patterns that we see as we continue practicing in our lives so that, we don't get caught in those patterns and turn them into ruts, deep ruts that we create for ourselves and then blame on everybody else. Because, wow, we'd be having such a great life if it only wasn't for, and then you fill in the blank. Fill in the blank. That's its own form of delusion. And so then the question becomes like, who is deluded? And what is the antidote to delusion? Or who is grasping, which is, you know, if you're familiar with the Four Noble Truths, the first noble truth is that there is suffering in the world. It's not life is suffering, but that there is suffering. Second noble truth is that the root cause of the kind of suffering that we have any autonomy over, any degree of agency over, is our self-identification, our clinging, our attaching personal pronouns to a story about it. The story of I like that and I want more of it, addictive behaviors of all kinds, greed, more for me, or I hate that, I don't want it, I hate those people because they want it or they have it or I don't have it, whatever that is. And can you feel the toxicity of that? And that's kind of like, they're both greed. Grasping and pushing away are both greed. And then hatred or anger or aversion is what we don't want, what we want to keep at the door so that we can have a good life. And then delusion is not recognizing how caught we are in greed and hatred and how lost we are in our own thoughts. And all of this can be like a soap bubble when you touch it with your finger, liberated in one moment. And then, of course, because we're so habituated to this, we got to liberate ourselves moment by moment by moment. But it's not like we are liberating ourselves because we don't really know who's breathing. We don't really know who is even imprisoned in our own thought structure. But maybe what we're closest to is awareness itself. Maybe that's who the real you is the one who knows. And who is that? And what is the relationship to the body? So the third noble truth, this is all in the form of a medical diagnosis. The diagnosis is dukkha or suffering. An etiology, the cause or root cause of suffering is that kind of clinging or pushing away. The prognosis, the third noble truth, is that there is a way out, that there is actually the potential for freedom from this kind of suffering. That's very, very good news. That's like the gospel, you know, that, which literally means good news. Okay, that there is the potential for healing, for liberation, from freeing ourselves from prisons of our own habitual constant constructing and reacting. And then the fourth noble truth is that there is a path, there is a treatment plan, so to speak, if you want to stay with the medical thing, that there's a diagnosis, etiology, prognosis, and then treatment plan. How are we going to take on this casualty of life that I am in this moment and tend to it with tenderness, with attention? They're all, in some sense, cognates, and it all has to do with attention. And whether we rob ourselves or whether it's Google and Facebook that are robbing us of our attention, it's still robbery. So can we actually drop back and drop in to the body in this moment, following that treatment plan? And let's say that all eight of the Eightfold Noble Path, which is the fourth noble truth, are related to mindfulness, and mindfulness is one of those path factors. And in fact, they're all interconnected. So if you go in one door, you're in the building, doesn't matter which door you go in. The important thing is to go in the building. And mindfulness, in some sense, is a kind of door that opens all the other doors. And the body is the biggest door of all. So for the remaining period of what you might think was a talk, but is actually meant to be a guided meditation, let's just rest here in awareness for no time. No agenda other than to recognize, realize that you're already whole, W-H-O-L-E, already awake, already here, already at home. And I can comfortably say that we're all at home because we're all at home. We're not in the same room, although we are in a very profound way in the same room, the room of the human heart, courtesy of the miracle of the technology. And befriending silence as if the befriending is a radical act of love and a radical act of sanity and a radical act of, I guess I'd say, embodying embodiedness, whatever it means to you. Can you be in the body in a way that, with no effort whatsoever, surrenders to your unique beauty, the unique constellation that we slap a name on and call it me, the real me, the true me, my true self, whatever you want to call it. And drop underneath all of those labels and words into the body, breathing right here, right now, into the heart and into the boundless spaciousness of your awareness that holds it all. Just this moment, just this breath, just this sitting here, just this being human, just this, just this. Noticing the impulse if the mind wants to cut out now. And let me make the suggestion that you notice that the mind wants to cut out now and don't cut out, don't leave, because it would in a certain way be abandoning yourself. We're going to shortly go into dialogue and conversation for another half hour. But in these few timeless moments that we have, maybe recognizing the preciousness of the opportunity to be with my screen says, you know, over 1,000 people at this particular moment, all practicing non-doing. All engaged in this for now, engaged in this love affair of life unfolding in a way that is truly embodied and aligned with what is your true nature. The beauty your parents saw in you the moment you were born, or someone saw in you soon after you were born. And that beauty has not diminished at all, no matter how old you are. It's only gotten more luminous, more radiant. But maybe a little bit shaded by all the busyness and the reactivity and the stress and the pain. That's really only part of the unfolding curriculum, and not in any way to be taken personally. So resting here in awareness in these final moments of this guided meditation, as if your very life depended on it, fully embodied in the unique manifestation, even if you're an identical twin, in the unique embodied manifestation of you, the flower on this planet that is you. And that you, that flower, this flower is so sorely needed in this moment in the world on an infinite number of different levels that none of us will ever fully understand. So let's see if we might not align ourselves with what's deepest and best and most beautiful and most authentic and most ethical in ourselves. Not as some ideal that we sort of imprison ourselves in, but as a way of being that we explore and experiment with and regulate out of wisdom, moment by moment by moment, as life continues to unfold. And then sitting in silence, fabulous. We need to do it every day for longer than you may feel comfortable with, because the mind will get impatient. So that's stretching a certain kind of envelope or exercising a certain kind of muscle. And we're engaging in this non-doing right here, wherever you are on the planet at this moment, and right now, in this timeless moment we call now. And perhaps formulating the intention, if you haven't developed it already, to let the formal practice and the informal practice of mindfulness and heartfulness become your go-to mode, your default mode, your instinctual impulse to tilt things, to incline the heart, so to speak, in the direction of stillness, clarity, kindness, embodied wakefulness. In every aspect of your life, and anchored with a period of time on the clock, a significant period of time on the clock, where you, in my languaging of it, sometimes get your ass on the cushion and keep it here longer than you may feel comfortable with. So sitting as if your life depended on it, because it does in more ways than you think and more ways than you can think. So now the good stuff starts. We have, as I understand it, some time to be in dialogue or to ask questions or make comments. This is a remarkable community, as are all communities of practice. And we really don't need to be talking with each other so much, but when we share our own experience of embodied wakefulness in whatever way, or challenges with feeling like we don't know what it means to be embodied or wakeful, the benefits of that are extraordinary, because we all share in those feelings. And so we teach each other. We wind up teaching each other. Everybody on this call is teaching everybody else, whether you know it or not, whether you get to raise your hand and be called on and ask a question or not, that there is a profound element of interconnectedness that's emerging just by whatever it is that got you here and that also kept you here. I mean, you've just realized, do you realize you've just wasted a perfectly good hour of your life doing absolutely nothing, listening to some mumbo jumbo about non-doing? From one perspective, that would be a very valid critique. From another perspective, it just shows total ignorance. But the most important thing is that, you know, when I rang these bells, for instance, the kiss of the bells only takes a second. But the sound goes on. In the same way, this time that we're together, this hour, hour and a half, or for that matter, if you've tuned into every single one of the presentations in this embodiment conference, still, it's 2 weeks, it'll be over. That's like the kiss, but the reverberations, they go on forever.